think we have some questions from the audience.
While we're taking questions from the audience, I know you're right. I just want to make one point about the flowy logic models. I think that the impulse from where that comes from is actually possibly a good impulse, which is, am I being irresponsible, thoughtful, or even bold, amazing,
sure,
kick-ass steward of this money?
You.
You know, I think sometimes that's where the desire to have a logic model-y, proof of concept-y thing comes from. It comes from an impulse to want to do well and do right. And so I just say, well, if that's where you're coming from, looking at implicit bias and looking through the lens of equity, what form could serve that function but actually be more useful to the people that you're trying to serve and be accountable to? I also want to say, if you're thinking about hiring, don't download a program officer description off the interwebs and then hire for that. Just don't do it. Think about what you're trying to accomplish, right? Think about purpose, you know? Think about the communities you're accountable to. And then think about the roles of staffing in your context that actually make sense. Like, why can't there be a, are we making sure we're learning officer, you know? Are we finding the woman and the queer folks and the folks in our community who are the most endangered, you know, physically, economically, and politically, and finding ways to resource and support them? That's not really an officer, like that doesn't like boil down into like a single person role. But when we think about hiring to build the infrastructure of these like small, agile, and I think it's great to be small and agile, there's nothing wrong with that. But when we think about building so that we have more capacity, we can be super creative about that, right? We don't have to download Atlantic Philanthropy's 17 different kinds of program officer descriptions. Okay, questions?
So this question is about endowments and how much money is parked in endowments and what we need to do to change that, because this 5% threshold payout rate, it's unjust. It's like a house is burning and you have all this water put out the fire and you're like, I'm just gonna spend 5% of the water to try to put out this fire. 5% will never put out this fire. And you're like, well, I'm saving up the 95% for future fires. The future fires are caused by the current fires that we don't put out. And yet, there we are, this 5%. That should be the minimum. It should not be the maximum that you put out every year. Like, we have 10 years left before climate change is irreversible. And yet, people are still squirreling money, hoarding it for some future when we may not have a future to save in the first place. So I think this is something that is really critical, and it does involve us all getting into policy and changing tax form. Whenever there was a movement to change the payout rate to 6% or something, and foundations opposed it with every fiber. Every single time this has been brought up, philanthropists have opposed it. And we just can't keep going. 95%, not only is it not being used, it's actually being invested in things that cause the problems that the 5% is used to put to address.
Yep. I have three questions here about applications. So is there a role for a common application that's brief and online? What's the alternative to an application that makes the grant opportunity available widely? And can you describe a due diligence process in a trust-based philanthropy model compared to traditional models? So, these are all great questions. I'll just say there have been efforts to create a common application for decades. The resistance comes from all the individual foundations who want all their individual things. Seriously, there have been some regional common application modules, but for the most part, what happens is each foundation wants everything articulated for them specifically, so that those efforts have failed. I think that the question about what due diligence looks like when you're doing proactive grant making is a really good one. You know, when we identify, so we wanted to fund civic engagement, and we wanted to fund civic engagement particularly in the South. And so we, once we did that, so then you could, you know, that, often at that point, most donors and funders say, okay, let's just put out an RFP in, you know, for civic engagement projects in the South. I think that we were too small of an outfit to consider and take in those the number of applications we would have gotten, and we would have had to reject like 99% of them. So is an open application process equitable if you're gonna reject 99%? And those folks, that 99% got their hopes up, you know, they stayed up all night, they filled out your application, they, you know, made everything in the font you wanted and the size of the font you wanted. If we're gonna reject 99% of those, and we know we are, then we have a question of whether or not that's true equity. Because I think there's a default of thinking open application processes. You know who wins in those processes? People who have really good writers on staff. Not David Innocencio. You know, and Vu just happens to be a great writer. But even he does not always win open application processes in the open market. So, you know, so once you identify really specifically like what, who and what you're trying to fund and why, then I think that you can use referral networks that are very diverse. And we have a very diverse board. Our trustees are, you know, probably one of the most diverse boards of trustees I've ever sort of seen or sat with. And so we have diverse referral sources both at the board level and then the nonprofit partner level. We go to our regional, our friend, like the people we know and have connections with in that region, and we ask, who is doing the amazing, amazing work but not getting funded? You know, which leaders are those? Like whose ideas are not being funded around civic engagement in the South? So in that way, we all, many roads would lead us back to a couple of different organizations. And then from there, we would do a lot of proactive due diligence without bothering them. You know, we would look up all their 990s online. We would look up things that, annual reports that they put out and just put online. I mean, there's a lot of information about many organizations if you just look for it. And so at that point, we realized, oh, we really do want to fund them. We want to meet with them. So we meet with them. And then there's another set of criteria that I didn't talk about in which we fund collaborative leadership that is sort of partner-oriented and learning-oriented. And I think this sector also really rewards charisma. And so we also look for leaders that are really operating with like a team of staff versus always being singular. We try to attend events and see what folks are like in space with the people, the communities they're trying to serve. And this is way more information than them filling out an application. You know, going to a community event or a program, you know, that somebody's putting on, and that means, yes, you're flying yourself there, right? It's inconveniencing us. That's really the biggest difference between come be supplicants to us and apply using our process, and then us coming to you and saying we're gonna do our own footwork to figure out if we're a good fit as an institution for you long term. And then, so that's a brief description of what trust-based grant making could look like. In the Whitman Institute's context, we do have many other funders in our network who do grant making differently, and I'm happy to connect you to some of those. Some of them do have kind of a modified application process. You know, and this question about does that mean the grant opportunity is widely available? I think that we're very honest about the limitations of our portfolio size and our reach. So we don't try to say that we're making the biggest difference in civic engagement nationally, because we don't think we can attribute our level of dollars to that. But we do say, I think we're funding some of the people that aren't getting funded that are doing really powerful long-term community and voter engagement work in the South. Women Engaged, for instance, is a group out of Georgia. They use both like data and normal community engagement measures to figure out how to get more young people of color to vote in Georgia. So that's, and we found them because, again, just really good referral networks. So that's, anyways, that's one take on trust-based grant making in our context, and there are others that you could find out through the project if you want.
I would say, I think we have to get out of this whole, like this, we need to be widely open to everyone idea. Because that's an idea based on equality, which is that if we just, we got 5 minutes, well, okay. that if we just have this, if we just be fair, then everyone can open, we would be open, and they can all have the opportunity to apply. And I think we have to get out of that. It's like equity is about targeting communities that are most affected by systemic injustice. And if your community has, you know, missing and murdered indigenous women, then you need to target your grants on that. If your community is disproportionately failing black folks, then you need to target funding going to the black community-led organizations. So this idea that we just need to like just open this wide and then we'll be fair to everyone, it's in a way kind of lazy. It's like you're expecting other people to come. It's kind of like a food bank saying, you know what, we want this food to be available to everyone who's hungry. So we're just gonna ask everyone to write an essay about how hungry they are, and then we're going to have a scorecard about how hungry people are, and then whoever writes the best essay about their hunger will give food to. That would be a lazy way for the food bank to go about distributing food, wouldn't it be? The food bank's job is to find the people who have most food insecurity and provide them with the food. That's what we have to think of philanthropy is. It's your job to find the communities that are most affected by injustice and removing all the barriers so that the money is going to those communities. And if people get mad, then, you know, screw them.
Thanks, Ru. So I have a couple more really good questions here. Current IRS regulations, don't they stipulate that 501c3s cannot be political? And how can we build power to change politics within the IRS? I think that those rules can actually be scrutinized. I mean, I think 501c3, well, obviously you can fund C4s, right, which actually are, you know, set out to do political work, like getting folks elected. And actually, again, it could be a habit where you think, I can only fund 501c3s. Why? You're a giving circle. You know what I mean? You can actually figure out how to set yourselves up to be able to give to 501c3s. If that's the orientation you have, like you want to build power, you want to get more women of color or people like Vu elected into office, you can give at a 501c4 level. There are also lots of activities that 501c3s do that build power that you don't have to be a C4 to do. So I would say there's a lawyer that we know named Jean Tom in San Francisco, and she and I are going to go on the road together because I heard her say multiple times to different rooms of funders, the constrictions you think are being placed upon you as a donor and a funder and a foundation are mainly imaginal, meaning there are some rules, right? But there's not as many as you think about kind of the policing of that kind of money, especially at the scale that we're probably giving at giving circles. So this is something that, you know, if you want to follow up with me and Jean about, I'm happy to talk about more. And the last kind of set of questions are like, you know, how do we reassure? There's one question about reassuring people that I want Vu to answer. But there's like one or two things that we can do when we get home to overcome resistance. You know, what are a couple things we can do as soon as we get back to our desks or get back to our giving circles? And there might be folks in the giving circle who aren't here yet. They're not kind of aligned with the messages that have been coming from this plenary stage. You know, I don't think it's ever too soon to be doing political development. You know, you're the one who puts programming and curriculum in front of your donors. So what kinds of experiences are you inviting them into? What kind of resources are you pointing at about how to hold this donor seat? Like we're sitting on donor seats that are on fire, and we're acting like we have time to deliberate. You know, I mean, I just think there's a way in which if somebody says, "Well, I don't know, it sounds too political," or "I'm not really about social justice," it's like, "Well, would you like to breathe air or live in a democracy?" I mean, between climate change and the populist state in multiple places on the planet, folks, these are real questions. Would you like to breathe air or live in a democracy or even in a socialist society? If it's yes to any of those things, we might want to really think about these concepts of what we can do right now. And then I think overcoming resistance, I used to run a business. I was a organizational development consultant and executive leadership coach. And my favorite coach used to say to me, almost everyone needs a coach who can give them like a stroke. You are doing so good, Pia. Oh my goodness, right? How are you even at work and dressed when you have a baby? You need that, right? And then you also every once in a while need a smack on the cheek. Like, it's stroke and smack. So, you know, and it's like, yeah, Pia, you should take a shower every day. We need both, right? So I'd say as the leaders of your giving circles, of your donor networks, you know, of a foundation or whatever, if you're in this room, you're leading a body of people, you know, even if it's your family. And so sometimes they need a stroke. You're doing so good with this giving. And sometimes they need a smack. Wake up, your chair is on fire. Let's do something different. Vu, why don't you wrap it up with your set of questions?
Yeah, there's some really good questions, everyone. And apologies that we won't be able to get through all of them. But we do have a session that's later on at 11 today.
He's afraid no one's going to come to our session. That's why he keeps saying that. He's like, we have a session later that we don't want to be alone in a room for.
Well, I just want to let people know that we have time later on to answer these questions in case we don't get to them. So I'm just going to go through these really quickly. How important is it for us to get larger foundations if you're a smaller organization? Yes, you actually, as a smaller organization or foundation, you can be so helpful. I remember some of the $5,000 unrestricted grants that I've got that were lifesavers, mm-hmm. especially during payroll times. Mm-hmm. So don't underestimate just how important if in the spirit of trust and relationship, then they can be $5,000, $1,000 can be so helpful. Don't underestimate that. About coaching, how is it important to help with professional development? Coaching is very important, especially right now when EDs, especially EDs of color, are burning out left and right, and that is a serious problem that we are not even talking about at all in this sector. So give money for sabbaticals and coaching and mentorship, professional development. Send people to Hawaii. I'm kind of serious about this. Right, people are afraid of where the money goes, so they don't donate because they're like, I don't want the money to go to overhead, whatever. That's all BS. You need to stop perpetuating it. Just tell them it's BS, and this is why, and explain it to them. But the more that you become apologetic and deferential, the more perpetuates this bullshit that is the overhead myth. So stop it. Right. How do you have, what strategies or tools can you suggest for nonprofit professionals to have conversations with donors and potential funders? We just need to have that conversation, but you, as potential donors and funders, you have more power. So you have to initiate many of these conversations. And you have to kind of drag it out of nonprofits. Because you're like, so how are we doing? They're like, I don't know. Yeah, you're doing great. You're great. Like, okay. But you have to ask several times before people will actually be honest with you. And if you actually give general operating funds, they're much more likely to be honest with you. I'm really serious. The research is behind that. And the last question is, what is the name of my mariachi band? It was called Los Panchos Vietnamitas. And I thought I was going to be Latino for a while. So that was, but I know Bo is trying to kick us off the stage. But going with what Pia said about the stroke and the slap, I know I do more slapping than stroking probably. So I do want to end on a stroke, which is, you all are amazing. I know this work. The last 3 days, you've been learning some very difficult concepts like racism, and it's very uncomfortable, and reparations, and all this stuff. And I yell at people a lot, and I will continue to do so. But I also am very appreciative of all that you do and all that you're trying to do. And let's work together as partners to move this forward. Thank you.